The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Andrew Nurkin. I'm the Deputy Director for Enrichment and Civic Engagement here at the Free Library. And it's my pleasure tonight to introduce Richard Blanco. Richard Blanco is the most recent, which is not to say the last, U.S. inaugural poet. In 2013, he made history four times at Barack Obama's second presidential inauguration. He was the first immigrant, the first Latinx person, the youngest person, and the first LGBTQ person to be the U.S. inaugural poet. Exploring heritage and identity, his poetry collections include City of 100 Fires, Directions to the Beach of the Dead, and Looking for the Gulf Motel. He is the author of The Prince of Los Cuyocos, a memoir that delves into his upbringing as the child of Cuban exiles and his artistic, sexual, and cultural identities as an American. Born in Madrid to Cuban exiles, Richard is an engineer by training, a fact that makes sense when one starts to notice just how meticulously assembled and solidly built his poems are. But a good engineer knows something about grace, too, and one can tell in reading Richard's poems that he's also a good and graceful engineer. This new book, How to Love a Country, asks what it might mean to love a place that has for so long been intent on dispossessing so many of its inhabitants, or what it might mean to belong in a life spent moving or being forced to move through borders, languages, cultures, and stories, or what it might mean to find the deepest and most interdependent of human connections across seemingly unbreachable chasms of human experience. Many of the bios you'll read online refer to Richard Blanco's, quote, occasional poems, which I take not to mean that he writes poems only occasionally, but that each poem marks in its own way the same astonishing occasion of our being alive together in this country today, with all the weird grief and pain and dogged joy and possibility that entails. Blanco has taught at Georgetown University, American University, the Writers' Center, Central Connecticut State University, and Wesleyan. He is currently distinguished visiting professor at Florida International University and lives in Bethel, Maine. That is a commute. Among his many honors, he was named the first education ambassador for the Academy of American Poets. Please join me in welcoming Richard Blanco to the Free Library.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you, Andrew, for, well, that's really not. thank you, Andrew, for that wonderful and astute introduction, especially the engineering part. So thank you, everyone, for being here. Thanks to everyone for putting together tonight. I know it takes a village to come together as a village in the name of poetry, to sit as around that proverbial campfire as libraries are. And I think you feel like I do, that something different happens when we experience literature, when we experience poetry together as a community, as it was always meant to be in some ways. Little known fact, and I don't know if even Andrew knows this, but I was a library page in my 20s, and I used to get in trouble a lot. Library pages basically just reshelve books. Back in the old days, when that's basically what libraries did, was this whole just checking out a book concept. And I used to get in trouble a lot just because I'd sit in the aisles, and like that's where I learned about operas and iguanas and everything else under the sun. And my stacks in the back room were always like this high. I had a girlfriend who was studying library sciences, and when I first started writing, she said, "Why don't you get a master's in creative writing?" I'm like, "You can get a master's in creative writing." So in some ways, I owe my entire career to a librarian. So thank you for that. And also, just walking around, we showed him the new space, how wonderful and amazing how libraries are reimagining themselves, right? And thinking about themselves as centers of learning in a communal sense, right? So that's just beautiful. And I'm glad to be back. I was here for the memoir. and I'm glad to be thrilled to be back. Writing can be a very solitary endeavor, as you can imagine. So also in that sense and spirit of community to thank you for coming out, even on this beautiful, is this perhaps the first spring day in Philadelphia? Second, there's still 6 feet of snow in Maine. So this is definitely spring for me. This is summer for me, actually. So thank you for coming out, because writing can be so such an isolated kind of endeavor. And what I do feels very real when I get to see real faces and real lives in front of me to share my work with. So you're all a gift to me, and thank you for that. They say that every poet is in some ways working on one poem all their life. In that sense, figuratively, of course, not literally, but figuratively, that in some ways every poet, every writer really, has some kind of central obsession, some kind of thing that happens in their life, and their whole entire body of work in some ways an attempt to address that obsession, to ask questions of that obsession, to answer them, to ask new questions and whatnot. For me, that obsession comes down to one single word, and that is home. Home and all that big word calls to mind, which is like asking what is love with respect to family, community, nationality, cultural identity, sexuality, even all these things tie to home. Home is a fundamental human need and a fundamental human urge and experience and a yearning. So I would say that sense of that obsession with home began with me perhaps before I was even born. As I like to say, I was made in Cuba, assembled in Spain, and imported to the United States. So my mother left 7 months pregnant from Cuba to Madrid, where I was born, and 45 days after my birth, we emigrated to the United States. So by the time I was 45 days old, I belonged to three countries: Cuba, Spain, and the United States. Had lived in two world-class cities. And so I think it's been with me. That's that imprint that has been with me all my life. Not that I knew it back then, but it was writing that made me remember those things that I didn't remember, or remember the questions I didn't even know I had. And so when I walked into my first creative writing classroom, graduate creative writing classroom, that obsession really, really came to surface. Here's what happened. My professor and mentor, who would be my mentor for 2.5 years after that, we read some Ginsberg and some Frost and the guy with the beard, Whitman, I was like, okay, this is kind of cool. The assignment was write a poem about America. And I went home and scratched my head. Mind you, I'm an engineer. As Andrew pointed to, this is my first, I'm sitting in a graduate classroom. I don't know my Whitman from my Frost, right? So like, I was thinking, what America is that they're talking about? I was like, why is Ginsberg so angry? My parents are immigrants and they love this country, right? What is he so angry about? So I went home again, scratched my head, and said, well, as they say, emotional truth is the only thing that really counts in a poem. And I wrote what I thought was just a silly account of, well, this is my America, or my yearning for America, and it had to do with Thanksgiving. and it became the first poem in the first book. So this is a Thanksgiving that, as a little sort of sheltered Cuban isolated kid in Miami, as we all know, which is a cultural bubble, this sense of what it meant to be American and this narrative of this is like the perfect Thanksgiving, which we never kind of had, right? This was Thanksgiving at my house, which, or as we like to say in Cuban, San Giving, like San Pedro or San Ignacio. It's a whole kind of other feast day, and which turns into a lot of spandex and dancing eventually. So I just want to take us back to that moment, just because actually it has everything to do with what the new book is about, and even my journey as presidential inaugural poet. Because I think, again, that obsession really never leaves you, right? It's your life's work, right? And it's not about finding an answer, but it's just really about keep on asking really good and great questions, as is all our lives, right? You should just need to know a couple things for this poem. Again, Thanksgiving, or there's the French influence where we sometimes say sans giving, which is without giving. So, And then for Cubans, you need to know that pork is not the other white meat. It's the only meat. Like, and I think we're of age in this crowd that understand that for the Cuban older Cuban exile community, JFK was not exactly their favorite president. So here we go. This was my first attempt at poetry. I was petrified. People laughed. People were crying. And something magical happened and started me on this journey. And it's called America. Although Tia Miriam boasted she discovered at least half a dozen uses for peanut butter, topping for guava shells and syrup, butter substitute for Cuban toast, hair conditioner, and relaxer, Mama never knew what to make of the monthly 5-pound jars handed out by the immigration department until my friend Jeff mentioned jelly. There is always pork, though. For every birthday and wedding, whole ones on Christmas and New Year's Eve, even on Thanksgiving Day, pork, fried, broiled, or crispy skin roasted, as well as cauldrons of black beans, fried plantain chips, and yuca con mojito. These items required a special visit to Antonio's Mercado on the corner of 8th Street, where men in guayaberas stood in Senate blaming Kennedy for everything. Ese hijo de puta! The bile of Cuban coffee and cigar residue filling the creases of their wrinkled lips, clinging to one another's lies of lost wealth, ashamed and empty as hollow trees. By 7, I had grown suspicious. We were still here. Overheard conversations about returning to Cuba had grown wistful and less frequent. I spoke English. My parents didn't. We didn't live in a two-story home with a maid or a wood panel station wagon, nor vacation camping in Colorado. None of the girls in my family had hair of gold. None of my brothers or cousins were named Greg, Peter, or Marcia. We weren't the Brady Bunch. And none of the black and white characters on Donna Reed or the Dick Van Dyke Show were named Guadalupe, Lázaro, or Mercedes. Patty Duke's family wasn't like us either. They didn't have pork on Thanksgiving. They ate turkey with cranberry sauce. They didn't have yuca. They had yams, like the diddles of pilgrims I colored in class. So a week before Thanksgiving, I explained to my abuelita about the Indians and the Mayflower, how Lincoln set the slaves free. I explained to my parents about the Purple Mountain's majesty, one if by land, two if by sea, the cherry tree, the tea party, the amber waves of grain, the masses yearning to be free, liberty and justice for all, until finally they agreed this Thanksgiving we would have turkey as well as pork. Abuelita prepared the poor fowl as if committing an act of treason, faking her enthusiasm for my sake. Mama set a frozen pumpkin pie in the oven and prepared candied yams following instructions I had to translate from the marshmallow bag. The table was arrayed with gladiolas. The plattered turkey loomed at the center on plastic silver from Woolworths. I uttered a bilingual blessing, and the turkey was passed around like a game of Russian roulette. Dry, Teoberto complained, and proceeded to drown the lean slices with pork fat drippings and cranberry jelly, la mierda roja esa, as he called it. Faces fell when Mama presented her ochre pie. Pumpkin was not a dessert. It was a remedy for ulcers. Tia Maria made 3 rounds of Cuban coffee, then Abuelo and Pepe cleared the living room furniture, put on a Selectus LP, and the entire family began to merengue over the linoleum of our apartment, sweating rum and coffee, until they remembered it was 1972 and 46 degrees in America. Thank you. So, flashing way forward to 2013, when the president called, basically he gave me the same assignment, write a poem about America. And part of me felt like saying, don't worry, big guy, I got this one. I've been writing on this theme for about 20 years back then. And so it was really it's very serendipitous that, and in conversations with him, obviously that's part of the connection is, of course, thinking about how a president like President Obama must have had to negotiate those same kind of spaces, right? Thinking, do I belong to this American narrative? Is this part of who I am? Thinking about, you know, I could see a little Ricky Obama, you know, asking very similar questions, although obviously in a different context. But you can imagine that my tenure as presidential inaugural poet, or PIP as I like to say, transformed every part of my life. And on a very personal note, it gave me, of course, a newfound sense of my place at the American table, so to speak, which did include pork and yuca and black beans and rice, right? And as a son of working class family of exiles, as a gay child, as a man, there was always still part of me, even at 44 when this happened, that didn't quite feel like I was part of the American narrative. And so the greatest challenge of writing the poem itself was to think about that and confront that, right? Even though I had been doing it on my work, in my work here and there, here I was asked to write a poem for the entire country, right? That's a very big, that raises the bar, so to speak, right? And so one of the hardest parts of writing the poem was not writing a poem itself, but really asking questions that I really had to face head on. One was, do I even love this country? Ended up being the title in some ways of the new book. And also, does this country love me back, right? Do I belong to that narrative? Am I still part of this world? Do I need to be Peter Brady, or in my case also Marsha Brady? And so the greatest gift of the inauguration, besides meeting Beyonce, which was amazing, I forgot to put her slide in there, but like, she smelled good too. It's beautiful, like, it's not makeup, she's gorgeous, was really to sort of feel I had a ribbon, so to speak, that again, I had that place. And not only just for me personally, but also for what I understood really was so many millions of people who, with similar stories, who probably always felt outside the margins of America. And I think that's basically what my space in that ceremony was, and I think that's the space that I've always been in, but that was just a very public moment to be able to do that. I also realized in a sense that narrative is something, not only that I belong to that narrative, right? That narrative have always existed. Of course, it's been prejudiced against, it's like been ignored, it's been outright like just pushed aside, right? As a gay man, as a Cuban, as any, so many people, like you had said, Andrew, so beautifully said, so many, a country, how was it that has pushed away so much, something to that effect, right? To get to do that. But I also realized that our country is a democracy, is a work in progress, right? And that it wasn't perfect. I mean, it felt like there was this great sense of hope, but also realizing we still had to work a lot. And we have. I mean, we really have, right? When I think back to the first presidential inaugural poet, Robert Frost, and in probably just a little more than 50 years, you have a gay immigrant, Latino engineer reading a poem, right? That speaks something to, you know, a democracy takes 3 steps forward and 5 steps back and 4 steps forward and whatnot. And so it reemphasized in me that sense that we all got to keep participating in democracy to keep on writing that story, to keep on writing that narrative. So I want to just take us back to that moment as a departure, another departure point. I'm thinking about what was going on through my mind, what was happening as I'm sitting here. I'm going to read a little piece of prose from the memoir about the inauguration, and then share the poem with you, and then take us up to today. In the moment, I feel America standing as one, putting differences aside and taking a deep collective breath. We pay tribute to something far bigger and more important than any one of us, and I truly feel like one of us, one of we, the people, and the echoes of the presidents and other speeches. I embrace America in a way I never had or thought I could, feeling for the first time that I belong, truly belong, to one country. Not an imaginary ideal from TV or a nostalgic Cuba floating in the sea of my parents' memories, but a real, tangible place that is mine, was mine, all along. Senator Schumer introduces me and calls me up to the podium. My mother squeezes my shoulder. I stand more confident than I imagined I would or could be, transfixed by the moment that is no longer about me or my poem or my glory, but about our country. Still, I'm surprised when the president and vice president stand up to greet me and shake my hand on my way to the podium. They both whisper something in my ear that I can't make out. But their gracious gestures speak silently to my heart, silently, as if saying, Richard, here is your country. This is your story. You are home. I step up to the podium, look out over the crowd, a patchwork quilt of lives, of stories spread across our ground, under our sky, beneath our one sun. I take it all in as I take one deep breath, then another. This is for them. This is for us, for all of us, I think to myself, and begin speaking into our wind. Mr. President, Mr. Vice President, America, one today. One sun rose on us today, kindled over our shores, peeking over the Smokies, greeting the faces of the Great Lakes, spreading a simple truth across the Great Plains, then charging over the Rockies. One light, waking up rooftops, under each one a story, told by our silent gestures, moving behind windows. My face, your face, millions of faces in morning's mirrors, each one yawning to life, crescendoing into our day. Pencil yellow school buses, the rhythm of traffic lights, fruit stands, apples, limes, and oranges arrayed like rainbows begging our praise. Silver trucks heavy with oil or paper, bricks or milk, teeming over highways alongside us, on our way to clean tables, read ledgers, or save lives, to teach geometry or ring up groceries, as my mother did for 20 years. So I could write this poem for us today. All of us, as vital as the one light we move through. The same light on blackboards with lessons for the day, equations to solve, history to question, or atoms imagined. The I have a dream, we keep dreaming. Or the impossible vocabulary of sorrow that won't explain the empty deaths of 20 children marked absent today and forever. Many prayers, but one light, breathing color into stained glass windows, life into the faces of brown statues, warmth onto the steps of our museums and park benches as mothers watch their children slide into the day. One ground, our ground, rooting us to every stalk of corn, every head of wheat sown by sweat and hands, hands gleaning coal and planting windmills in deserts and hilltops that keep us warm, hands digging trenches, hands routing pipes and cables, hands as worn as my father's, cutting sugarcane so my brother and I could have books and shoes. The dust of our farms and deserts, our cities and plains mingled by one wind, our breath. Breathe. Hear it through the day's gorgeous din of honking cabs, buses launching down avenues, the symphony of footsteps, guitars, and screeching subways, the unexpected songbird on your clothesline. Hear squeaky playground swings, trains whistling or whispers across cafe tables. Hear the doors we open for each other all day, saying, hello, shalom, buongiorno, howdy, namaste, or buenos dias. In the language my mother taught me, in every language, spoken into one wind carrying our lives without prejudice as these words break from my lips. One sky, since the Appalachians and Sierras claimed their majesty, and the Mississippi and Colorado worked their way to the sea. Thank the work of our hands, weaving steel into bridges, finishing one more report for the boss on time, stitching another wound or uniform, the first brushstroke on a portrait, or the last floor on the Freedom Tower jutting into a sky that yields to our resilience. One sky toward which we sometimes lift our eyes, tired from work, some days guessing at the weather of our lives, some days giving thanks for love that loves you back, sometimes praising a mother who knew how to give, or forgiving a father who couldn't give what you wanted. Still, we head home. Home through the gloss of rain or weight of snow or the plum blush of dusk, but always, always home, always under one sky, our sky, and always one moon, like a silent drum tapping on every rooftop and every window of one country. All of us facing the stars and hope, a new constellation still waiting for us to map it, still waiting for us to name it together. Thank you. So, the inauguration, besides having obviously a transformative effect on me personally and my place in America, also had a change in my creativity, my aesthetic, what I think a poem can do or should do in the world. I don't know that you can really separate those two in any case, but and I started thinking about sort of what is the civic role of the poet in a society, or the civic-minded poet, or what is the poetry of social conscience. I don't consider myself, even with this book, a political poet, but thinking about it in those terms. How do we step up and sort of invite a different kind of conversation? How do we be political in ways that are still compassionate and honest and see through the gray and are not on the polarized ends of black and white? And that's essentially what this book, How to Love a Country, is about. It investigates those issues that we're still dealing with, that have had to deal with historically, and a message perhaps that in our moment right now is perhaps even more timely than I even expected it to be. And again, I think a democracy goes through waves and steps forward and steps backward. And I often think, you know, it was the worst of times, it was the best of times, right? 68 wasn't such a great year, as far as I remember it, even though I was born in 68. But the point is that we have to work through this, right? And I think, though the book protests, it's also about ultimately remembering what we need to get back to and how we can have a dialogue, how poetry can stimulate a dialogue, can be a sort of a catalyst, can have ripple effects. And so it's not this kind of, like, I didn't want it to be this kind of one-sided political rant, this kind of preaching to the choir, because I don't think that accomplishes anything. I think until empathy enters the room, really nothing really is going to change, right? And so that's part of what makes it throughout the book, I hope. The book is composed of a mosaic of three different kinds of poems. I have occasional or commemorative poems, like the inaugural poem, but also poems I've written for Boston Strong, for the Pulse nightclub shooting, for the Parkland High School shooting, which I'll share with you later. And then some autobiographical poems that are still rooted in my question and obsession of home. And also some ekphrastic poems, which are poems written about. I had a project with a photographer named Jacob Hesler, and we wrote 12 poems and 12 photographs on the theme of boundaries. So these are part of this book. And I got to say again that ultimately it feels like a different book for me, and it is, but it still comes back to that obsession of home, except I'm asking that question in a larger context, because that moment changed me. It wasn't just about am I Cuban or American, you know, like, but what does home mean to us, right? What is that big American table? Who gets to sit at the table? And thinking about that, not just from a totally autobiographical and self-centered way, but really about thinking about breaking boundaries in that way too, like thinking about how can I empathize, how can I bring empathy to these others, how can I write about stories that don't necessarily belong to me, but I can speak for them and advocate for them, and I can be a champion of them. This first poem I'll share with you from the collection is kind of a hybrid. It's a very autobiographical poem in the sense it's a poem about my mother. That's my mother, if you haven't figured it out yet. That's my favorite photograph of her in Cuba long before I was even an idea. And that's her with me at the inauguration. She was the person I chose to sit right next to me because in some ways she is more of an American than I could ever be. And for her journey, she left her entire family behind in Cuba. By that I mean her parents, all 8 brothers and sisters, every niece and nephew, every aunt and uncle, every niece and nephew. And I realized that her story was not just one of loss and of longing, but one of faith in the ideals of this country. And to make that kind of leap took an amazing amount of faith. And so for the third poem, I don't know if it's common knowledge, but the White House asked me to write 3 poems. and they chose one today, obviously. So this is the third poem that asks us to put ourselves in my mother's emotional shoes as a way of looking at our country through the eyes of an immigrant who looks at it with fresh eyes, right? Who makes these perilous journeys, who loses so much, and holds America to those ideals. You don't mess with my mother and those ideals, right? Those of us, including myself, that I was raised here for the most part, or those who are born here or have been here for generations, the things we take for granted. Thinking about if you all had to get up off of your seats tonight and have 4 hours to pack a bag and leave to never see anything that you knew again, how might we fight for what we need to fight for a little bit more? How might we acknowledge and appreciate what we need to a little bit more? How might we have that conversation with the neighbor or the person in the elevator out of a different space if we knew what was perhaps, if the stakes were a little bit higher? And they are right now. For reasons that, okay, I'm not going to run for office. Blanco for president. 45 days. By 45 days, I missed it. And I was named after Richard Nixon, actually. Not for political reasons. They had no idea he was just president-elect when we were in Madrid. So this is that poem about my mother. Mother country, madre patria. To love a country as if you've lost one. 1968, my mother leaves Cuba for America, a scene I imagine as if standing in her place. 1 foot inside a plane destined for a country she knew only as a name, a color on a map, or glossy photos from drugstore magazines. Her other foot anchored to the platform of her patria, her hand clutched around 1 suitcase, taking only what she needs most. Hand-colored photographs of her family, her wedding veil, the doorknob of her house, a jar of dirt from her backyard, goodbye letters she won't open for years. The sorrowful drone of engines, 1 last deep breath of familiar air she'll take with her. 1 last glimpse at all she'd ever known. The palm trees wave goodbye as she steps onto the plane. The mountains shrink from her eyes as she lifts off into another life to love a country. As if you've lost one. I hear her. Once upon a time, reading picture books over my shoulder at bedtime, both of us learning English, sounding out words as strange as the talking animals and fair-haired princesses in their pages. I taste her first attempts at macaroni and cheese, but with chorizo and peppers. And her shame over Thanksgiving turkeys, always dry, but countered by her perfect pork pernil and garlic yuca. I smell the rain of those mornings huddled as one under 1 umbrella, waiting for the bus to her 10-hour days at the cash register. And at night, the zzz, zzz of her sewing her own blouses and quinceañera dresses for her grown nieces still in Cuba, guessing at their sizes. and the gowns she sell to neighbors to save for a rusty white sedan, no hubcaps, no air conditioning, sweating all the way through our first vacation to Florida, theme parks, to love a country as if you've lost one, as if it were you on a plane departing from America forever. Clouds closing like curtains on your country, the last scene in which you're a madman scribbling the names of your favorite flowers, trees, and birds you never see again. Your address and phone number you never use again. The color of your father's eyes and your mother's hair, terrified you could somehow, someday, forget these. To love a country. As if I was my mother, last spring, hobbling, insisting I help her climb all the way up to the U.S. Capitol, as if she were here before you today instead of me, explaining her tears, her cheeks pink as the cherry blossoms coloring the air that day, when she stopped, turned to me, and said, "You know, Mijo, it isn't where you're born that matters. It's where you choose to die. That is your country." Right. So part of my mother's statement, which has stayed with me all my life, is it's literal and figurative, of course, but it's this idea of what is home, right? Where will your ashes or your bones, what is home? And she's come to a point in her life that although she's yearned and lost a lot and looked back to Cuba a lot, that, as she says, thank God for Castro, because in a way, if it wasn't for Castro and having to flee Cuba, she wouldn't have had what this country offered her. And she reminds us of that all the time. And she's lived more years here than obviously now than she's lived in Cuba. And so this idea of where's that home, really? What is your final loyalty? Not a literal dying, but thinking about where would you want to live forever, so to speak. This is my dad. Myself as a toddler, obviously, and my older brother, and the other member of the family, the plastic-covered sofa, which is a staple for... the immigrant staple. I think if the cat would have stayed still long enough, my mother would have wrapped it in plastic too. That whole immigrant work, you know, we saved for this sofa, we gotta preserve all the things we have. I suppose about my dad, obviously, and it's, my dad lost in another way. His whole family came, or most of the family, and so, but he lost, I think, in a different way. He lost because as a man of that generation, suddenly to have to, all his dreams and all the plans he had about, you know, his family and all the stuff were suddenly exploded, right? This, especially back then, you know, I'm the man of the house, going to take care of the family, you know, all that, you know, wife's not going to work, that kind of idea, right? And in a way, exile sort of emasculated him in some ways. And it also sort of, I think both of them went through some kind of PTSD, actually. I mean... You'd land in Madrid with 7 months pregnant and with a 6.5-year-old boy and with 50 cents in your pocket. I mean, that does stuff to people, right? So I think my mother became more of a looking back, and that was what kept her sane and eventually going to Cuba and reuniting with her family after 10 years. My dad had nothing to go back to in a way, and so that was even a little more confusing in a way, right? And he was... I think became a little emotionally handicapped and became a very quiet man. So this poem is a little bit about that, and ultimately really it's just a praise and a thanks that I think I never gave him. My father in English. First half of his life lived in Spanish, the long syntax of Las Montañas that lined his village, the rhyme of sol with his soul, a Cuban alma that swayed with Las Palmas, the sharp rhythm of his machete cutting through caña, the syllables of his canarios that sung into la brisa of the island home. He left to spell out the second half of his life in English, in the vernacular of New York City sleet, neon, and glass, and the brick factory where he learned to polish steel 12 hours a day, enough to save enough to buy a used Spanish-English dictionary he kept bedside like a Bible, studied 15 new words after his prayers each night, then practiced them on us the next day. Buenos dias, indeed, my family. Indeed, mas café. Have a good day today, indeed. And again in the evening, gracias to my bella wife, indeed, for dinner. Hiciste tu homework, indeed? Indeed, la vida es difícil. Indeed did indeed become his favorite word, which, like the rest of his new life, he never quite grasped, overused, and misused, often to my embarrassment. Yet the word I most learned to love and know him through. Indeed, the exile who tried to master the language he chose to master him. Indeed, the husband who refused to say, I love you, in English to my mother. The man who died indeed without true translation. Indeed, meaning in fact and efecto, meaning in reality, the hecho, meaning to say now what I always meant to tell him in both languages. Thank you, gracias, for surrendering the past tense of your life so that I may conjugate myself here in the present of this country. In truth, así es, indeed. So it occurs to me now that this idea of loving a country and what this book represents is more than just about the United States, but it's something just obviously I've been floating around with. I have two countries to think about and how to love, right? Maybe three. But when I was asked to write and read a poem for the reopening of the U.S. Embassy in Cuba, which I never thought would happen in my lifetime, there was a sense of realizing that much of my work, in some ways, was an attempt to, in some ways, heal myself, but also really to sort of take up the pains of my parents and sort of try to do something with that, and try to process that and try to honor it and try to, as my professor always said, be an emotional historian of your world. And remember those stories, we're storytellers, right? At the end of the day. And so that was an amazing sort of moment. And in some ways it also, I was able to let go of it at the same time, if that makes sense. There was a certain sense of closure, a threshold of some kind that allowed me to in a way let go of Cuba, because I felt like there's a story that was finished there for my parents and I think for myself as well. So it's a little more complex than that, because then of course everything's gone to pot after that, right? Now we're back in sort of this unresolvedness with Cuba again, and so the poem is in the book. I'm not going to share it with you in the interest of time, but this is one of the most moments that I think will flash before my eyes before I die. So let's talk about another unresolved border that may be closer to home, so to speak, the U.S.-Mexico border. And more specifically, this is one of the photos, obviously, from Jacob Hessler from the collaborative book. This is part of the Rio Grande, or the Rio Grande, that creates part of the border. And this poem, as I looked at this photo, I just started thinking about the absurdity of borders, especially when it comes to the South. Right, this idea that there's, oh, I'm in America now, right? As if this region hasn't shared hundreds and hundreds of years of history, of culture, of people. If there is a border, it's 800 miles wide, right? And so thinking about that, and thinking about also, I don't know about y'all, but y'all. I had to go to Texas for that. but I've been hearing about this Mexican immigration problem since I was a kid, right? We've all been in hearing about this. And I got to say, at some point you realize, and also given my perspective from Latin America and from another culture, there's a lot of BS going on. I mean, and I think on both sides of the aisles. I'm sorry to, this book really just calls a spade, so to speak, you know. This is a political ping pong ball that we've been dealing with for like constantly, right? Don't mean to tell me that there isn't an equitable and fair and humane solution, isn't even the right the word, agreement of what's going on. And also, I also blame the media in some ways because they don't tell the whole damn story. I mean, I've come from Latin America. I've lived in Guatemala. I've had projects in orphanages in Honduras that I work with the girls there. And it's really about class at the end of the day. And it's about maintaining a certain, nobody wants a solution because at the end of the day, historically, throughout time, the people that suffer in the crossfire of history are always the poor and the destitute. And so, you know, they're abused here. They don't, well, we don't want them, but yeah, but we want them. We don't want them, but we want them. And over there, they don't want them. They're like, it's your problem. And then they blame the United States. And it's like this constant ping-ponging, it's like of the Western Hemisphere, that's just to the point of annoying already, right? I mean, give me a break. So anyway, the only way I was able to think about and resolve that was to let the river speak and sort of let the river be heavy-handed to all of humanity for these kinds of absurd, these kind of absurd notions of place or identity or borders and whatnot. So yeah, this is a personification poem in the voice of the river. Complaint of El Rio Grande, Foilin by Berry. I was meant for all things to meet, to make the clouds pause in the mirror of my waters, to be home to fallen rain that finds its way to me, to turn eons of loveless rock into lovesick pebbles and carry them as humble gifts back to the sea that brings life back to me. I felt the sun flare, praised each star flocked about the moon long before you did. I breathed air you'll never breathe, listened to songbirds before you could speak their names, before you dug your oars in me, before you created the gods that created you. Then countries, your invention, maps jigsawing the world into colored shapes, caves and bold lines to say you're here, not there, you're this, not that, to say yellow isn't red, red isn't black, black is not white, to say mine, not ours, to say war, and believe life's worth is relative. You named me Big River, drew me blue, thick, to divide, to say Spic and Yankee, to say Wetback and Gringo. You split me in two, half of me us, the rest them, but I wasn't meant to drown children, hear mother's cries, never meant to be your geography, a line, a border, a murderer. I was meant for all things to meet. The mirrored clouds and suns tingle, bird songs in the quiet moon, the wind and its dust, the rush of mountain rain, and us. Blood that runs in you is water flowing in me. Both life, both the truth we know, to be one in another. Thank you. So this is one of the commemorative pieces. So as you can imagine, the presidential inaugural gig is the most public moment for poetry. And so a lot of organizations have asked me then to write commemorative or occasional poems and to celebrate this or that or the other. Even people that I don't know have asked me to write birthday poems. I'm like, that I can't do. I don't even know you. And one of the organizations that reached out was Freedom to Marry, which was founded by Evan Wolfson, which was really one of the organizations that's really key in changing the rhetoric that really, at the end of the day, was the tipping point that passed the final legislation in the Supreme Court. And I love that because ultimately it said language matters, right? And it was also with empathy and with compassion. And not to say that we didn't, not to say that everything else before it was wrong and that work didn't count. But there was a time where, you know what, we need to just switch this up a little bit, right? And the idea was this idea that appealing to people's empathy, right, and compassion. And we're just human beings, period. End of story. Anything else you want to think is your problem, right? And so they changed the rhetoric. And so this was before the final legislation. This was for their 10-year anniversary. It was just on the brink of what happened was a watershed after that. So we talked a lot about the poem and what I wanted to do and whatnot. It's obviously, these are clips from, oh, I forgot to say, they're also, you're wondering, what are all these pictures? They, for their anniversary, they also commissioned a director and a producer to make a short film, which is absolutely wonderfully done. And these are clips from that short film, which you can look up on YouTube, just Until We Could, Richard Blanco, Freedom Mary, it'll come up. It was really interesting. I had no creative control of the film, but it was a poem that I wrote, like thinking it was through a cinematograph, I don't know how to say that, knowing that it was going to be a film. And so I was picturing like Brian Gosling and like Brad Pitt making out, you know? And it wasn't quite that, but but it's beautifully done. And so this was also obviously based in some ways autobiographically, because every poem in some ways has an autobiographical experience. So this is based loosely, not loosely, more than loosely, on my life with my partner, Mark. At the time we weren't married, we're still not married, although I always say he's my husband because I'm embarrassed. We've been together for 21 years, but he just proposed last Saturday, so. Because I just had to say, we've both been very busy and crazy since the inauguration, and but I said, you know, we keep on talking about it. I said, I just told him, somebody's got to propose, and it ain't gonna be me, because I don't feel that role. I'm like, I still want to be like that 1950s housewife with like a basting turkeys with a pearl choker and like pleated skirt, like. I'm the domestic, ironically, I'm the poet who's mostly sustained the household for 5 years. God's a comedian. but anyway, here we go. This is, and I really intend it as a love poem for all of us, regardless of sexuality. Of course, it's rooted in this, but it's really about appealing to that idea that love is love, and that's part of the line in here. Until We Could, for Mark. I knew it then, when we first found our eyes in our eyes and everything around us, even the din and smoke of the city, disappeared, leaving us alone as if we were the only two in the world. Two mirrors, face to face, my reflection in yours, yours in mine, infinite. I knew, since I knew you, but we couldn't. I caught the sunlight pining through the shears, traveling millions of dark miles simply to graze your skin. As I did that first dawn, I studied you sleeping beside me. I counted your eyelashes, read your dreams like butterflies flitting under your eyelids, ready to flutter into the room. Yes, I praised you like a majestic creature my God forgot to create. Until that morning of you tamed in my arms, first for me to see and name you mine. Yes, to the rise and fall of your body, your every exhale and inhale a breath I breathed, wanting to keep even the air between us as one. Yes, to all of you. Yes, I knew. But still, we couldn't. I taught you how to dance salsa by looking into my Caribbean eyes. You learned to speak in my tongue while teaching me how to catch a snowflake in my palms and love the gray clouds of your worn-out hometown. Our years began collecting in glossy photos, timelining our lives, across shelves and walls, glancing back at us, us embracing in some sunset, more captivated by each other than the sky, blushed plum rose, us claiming some mountain that didn't matter as much as our climbing it together, us leaning against columns of ruins as ancient as our love was new, or leaning into our dreams at a table, flickering candlelight into our full mooned eyes. I knew me as much as us, and yet we couldn't. Though I forgave your blue eyes turning green each time you lied and kept believing you, though we managed to say good morning after muted nights in the same bed, though every door slam told me to hold on by letting us go, and saying you're right became as true as saying I'm right, till there was nothing a long walk couldn't solve, holding hands, hope under streetlights, lustering like a string of pearls guiding us home, or a stroll along the beach with our dog, the sea washed out by our smiles, our laughter roaring louder than the waves. Though we understood our love was the same as our parents, though we dared to tell them so, and they understood, though we knew we couldn't, no one could. When fiery kick lines and fires were set for us by our founding mother fathers at Stonewall, we spoke of defiance. When we paraded glitter, leather, and rainbows, our word then became pride down every city street, demanding just let us be. But that was not enough. Parades became rallies, bold words on signs shouting, until we all claimed freedom as another word for marriage and said, let us in, insisted love is love. Proclaimed it into all eyes that would listen, at any door that would open, until no's and maybes turned into yeses, town by town, city by city, state by state. Understanding us and all those who dared to say enough, until the gravel struck into law what we always knew. Love is the right to say, I do, and I do, and I do. And I do want us to see every tulip we've planted come up spring after spring. 100 more years of dinners cooked over shared glasses of wine, and 1,000 more movies in bed. I do, until our eyes become voices speaking without speaking. I do, until, like a cloud meshed into a cloud, there's no more you, me, our names useless. I do want you to be the last face I face, my breath, your last. I do. I do and will for all those who still can't vow it yet, but know love's exact reason, as much as we know how a sail keeps the wind without breaking, or how roots dig away into the earth, or how the stars open their eyes into the night, or how a vine becomes one with the wall it loves, or how when I hold you, you are still rain in my hands. Thank you.
Okay. You either have time for one more time or a question.
So okay. Sure. All right. So I'm going to close on another note. So, one of the things that I obviously tried to do in this poem, there's a lot of protests in this poem. There's poems about gun violence. There's poems about St. Louis. There's poems about all sorts of things. This is one of the last poems. I also wanted to make sure we leave us in the space of hope and of and remembering the institutions and our ideals. Because if we lose those, then all bets are off, so to speak. So in thinking about patriotism and what does that mean, thinking about what does it mean to love a country, right? Because the book's title is both a question It's a statement, it's a how-to book, it's all those things and all those nuances. So I was thinking about patriotism in this particular way, the innocent kind of patriotism. We all want to belong to a country. We all want to belong to something, to some place. We all want a home, right? And the different categories of home, one of those includes belonging to a nation, right? But thinking about my childhood and that innocent kind of patriotism where before party affiliations and before, God, before CNN and Fox, like before cable news, right, where you're not jaded by any of this, but you just really feel a sense of belonging and wonder, especially in this country, which I think was so new to all of, I mean, it's 200, that's not even 300 years old, right? Even though they think this is old here, but really, it's all sort of, in a way, fresh to many generations that just sort of was a connection point. And so for me, that became always the song America the Beautiful, Amber Waves of Grain. So I just sort of went back to that because we've been doing a lot of screaming lately. And I think this poem is about how can we start singing again. America the Beautiful, again. Sorry, I can't sing like Beyonce, but I'll try. Oh, sorry. See, I went wrong right there. That was a C sharp, I don't even know. I'm tone deaf, actually, for the most part. How I sang it, oh beautiful, like a psalm at church with my mother, her Cuban accent scaling up every word, oh beautiful, yet in perfect pitch, delicate and tuned to the radiant beams of stained glass light. How she taught me to fix my eyes on the crucifix as we sang our thanks to our Savior for this country that saved us. Our voices, hymns as passionate as the organ piping toward the very heavens. How I sang, for spacious skies, closer to the skies while perched on my father's sunbeat shoulders, towering above our first 4th of July parade. How the timbre through our bodies mingled, breathing, singing as one with the brass notes of the marching band playing the only song he ever learned in English. How I dared to sing it at assembly with my teenage voice crackling for amber waves of grain. That one I can do. That I'd never seen, nor the purple mountains' majesties, but could imagine them in each verse rising from my gut. Every exclamation of praise I belted out until my throat hurt. America, and again, America. How I began to read Nietzsche and doubt God, and still wished for God to shed his grace on thee and crown thy good with brotherhood. I still want to sing, despite all the truth of our wars and our gunshots ringing louder than our school bells, our politicians smiling lies at the mic, the deadlock of our divided voices shouting over each other instead of singing together. How I want to sing again, beautiful or not, just to be harmony from sea to shining sea with the only country I know enough to know how to sing for. Thank you, everyone. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.